This is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, May 20th, 2020. Producing from his home studio in Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio just north of New York City. So last night, ESPN broadcast the David Freese game, game six of the 2011 World Series, in which the Cardinals were repeatedly one strike away from losing the World Series, the Rangers. And today, as we continue Coaches Week, we talk with the man who managed the Rangers that night, Atlanta Braves third base coach Ron Washington, who has strong feelings and memories about what happened. And we'll also talk with Paul Imbakides, and we'll hear from Carlos Carrasco, who recovered from leukemia last summer and now faces a difficult choice in whether to play if baseball returns amid heightened risks. Before we get to all that, some notes. The Washington Nationals will unveil their World Series rings on Sunday in a virtual event. The Nationals said the hour-long event, which will start at 7 p.m., will be streamed on the team's website and social channels. It will also air on MLB Network and on Masson. The Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim will furlough non-playing employees on June 1st. They've informed staffers that this is going to happen. Members of the front office, analytics department, scouting staff, and the vast majority of those involved with their minor league system, including coaches, coordinators, and player development support staff, will be impacted. The Oakland Athletics have not paid their rent to use Ring Central Coliseum, according to the interim executive director of the Stadium Authority. Henry Gardner told the Bay Area News Group on Tuesday that the team had informed the Stadium Authority it could not pay the $1.2 million annual rent that was due on April 1st, citing the coronavirus pandemic. And finally, the New York Post published an internal Major League Baseball memo from late March that seems to indicate the players' union leadership was aware of the team's needs to renegotiate player salaries if baseball played games without fans in the stands. That memo would seem to run counter to some of the union's public statements. We'll get into this a little bit coming up with Paul Imbakides. And before we hear from Hembo, from Ron Washington, from Carlos Carrasco, I want to tell you about Shippo. For e-commerce businesses, shipping in 2 days or less is the new standard. As a growing business, how can you keep up? Introducing Shippo, your business's new secret weapon. Shippo is the only shipping software for growing businesses that you can start today, set up in minutes, and then ship today. Because they ship hundreds of millions of packages, Shippo's volume discount saves you up to 90% off of carrier rates. Simply connect your online store to Shippo. No coding or technical expertise required. They will instantly identify the lowest shipping rates from 55-plus global carriers like UPS, the United States Postal Service, FedEx, and DHL. Your orders are automatically pulled in and ready to go. Just click, print, and ship. Plus, automated return labels are free. You only pay if your customers use them. Companies that use Shippo save thousands of dollars, free up hours of valuable time, and on average, grow 77% year over year. Join 100,000 companies like Goat, Hims, and MeUndies who are saving up to 90% off carrier rates with Shippo. For our listeners, they're offering their best discount available anywhere. Get a shipping consultation and Shippo Pro Plan 6-month trial for free at GoShippo.com/BBTN. That's up to a $700 value for free at GoShippo.com/BBTN. Go right now and get your shipping consultation and Shippo Pro Plan 6-month trial for free at GoShippo.com/BBTN.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Why, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
And Hembo is Paul Imbakides. He's a researcher at ESPN. He's a honcho on the show, Get Up. But as we've learned, it's much more that he's a wild partier who facilitates Mike Greenberg. Now, I'm glad that we finally settled on that, Hembo.
after about a year of me fabricating what I actually do on the show, I was finally exposed last week. So I'm actually sort of surprised that I was invited back now, like now that I've been shown a fraud. But you guys are having some grace on me. I appreciate
it. Well, and we're more under control here, okay? Our show's a little bit more under control. So we don't mind if you're kind of parting off on the side and still being on our show. Now, have you seen the movie War of the Roses?
War of the Roses. I can't say that rings a bell. Come on!
Seriously? Okay, Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner, it's like a lesson for the youngins here. They're a divorcing couple that gets into a knockdown, drag-out fight over the house that they've shared. And as they stake out territories in that house, in the end, they effectively wreck the house. That's what I was thinking of last night when I read the latest story in the back and forth between the two sides. A leaked internal memo from Major League Baseball. Of course, that's what the owners do. They leak, which seems to back up their what they've said, that they had an opportunity to renegotiate player salaries. We move forward. There's a denial from the Players Association back and forth in that article, back and forth last night. And I just continue to shake my head saying they need to get along. They're going to, with all this back and forth, they're going to damage the golden goose, Hembo.
They don't need to get along as much as they just need to put their egos aside and be grown up.
Yes.
In this ancient movie that you share, this would be Rob Manfred and Tony Clark wrecking each other's house, like wrecking their house. I totally agree with you in the sense that they just can't get out of their own way. We've talked about this now a few times, and it never ceases to amaze me how little progress we've made, because like we were seemingly having a very similar conversation last week and the week before. And I read the New York Post article this morning as well. It seems pretty clear to me, at least, that a couple months ago, the union acknowledged that, given the fact that there's a lot of uncertainty moving forward, potentially without fans, that these financial conversations would be up for debate. What's incredible to me is now that we stand here less than a week before Memorial Day, that not only have we not made considerable progress, there's still the extraordinary lack of goodwill that is being, like you said, publicly portrayed in such an irresponsible way. It's the worst possible time to do it. It really blows me away.
Yeah, 100%. I had an agent say to me, I don't know if you saw what I wrote the other day, saying that in this moment, because the owners really need this season to happen more than the players do, in this particular moment, the players have some leverage. And they could theoretically parlay that into future considerations for free agency, for service time manipulation, for tanking. And an agent said, do you think that, these guys have enough time to work it out? And I said, hey, last month we saw Republicans and Democrats work out a $3 trillion stimulus package in a week. You would hope that baseball officials and the union could work out any kind of a CBA adjustment over the course of what it's been, 2.5 months?
Yeah, and 2.5 months, and we also have nothing better to do either.
Right.
Hunter, your column was outstanding, because what you said in it that I totally agreed with, I think it's hard to deny that the Major League Baseball Players Association, the union, can make considerable strides if they're willing to play the long game. If you're not worried about the here and now, if you're not worried about how much money am I bringing home for myself this season, if and when we play, and you can take a look at the broader scope here, because right now I would say it's pretty obvious, pretty easy to say that salaries have really stagnated over the last few years, and there's obviously a wide variety of reasons for that. But now is the time. This is probably the most leverage that the union has had, I don't know, 20, 25 years. And if you can just harness some of that and be able to show, 50-50 goodwill in some sense, at least, you might be able to get somewhere. And right now, I don't see that happening, because these both of these sides are dug in with their heels so much. There's also a lot of pride here, I think. And these are the sort of the tactics that we typically use, with these kinds of, labor issues back and forth. But this is not your typical, 1994, 1995 type player strike. This is a one in a kind thing. And the players have to be able to look past the here and now. And so does union leadership. And I don't see that happening based on what I'm reading and based on what I'm hearing.
I think that thought process is much more prevalent among the rank and file, but to date, it hasn't been reflected in how the union leadership is handling it, and it certainly hasn't been reflected in how the owners have been handling it, because these leaks are standard operating procedure, and they're destructive, and I cannot figure out why they can't get into a room and try to work it out that way. So coming up, we're going to be interviewing Ron Washington. And one of the players that I'm going to ask him about is Josh Hamilton, who, of course, was such a force for the Rangers in the best of times, but has had such a troubled history. What do you got on Josh Hamilton?
Buster, I've never met Josh Hamilton, but I do know people that know him well. I played college baseball, and for spring break every year, we went down to Clearwater and we trained at the Winning Inning. The Winning Inning, for those who don't know, is the place in Clearwater, Florida, at Jack Russell Stadium, that Josh Hamilton was, you know, for lack of a better term, rehabbed back into Major League Baseball. And there was a group of people there, a few, gentlemen in particular, that not only kept him on the straight and narrow, from a health standpoint, but also helped, you know, bring him back from a baseball standpoint, because obviously he had been, you know, so far removed from the game for so long. They told me a story once, Buster, that I will never forget. And that's that after years, literally years, of Josh Hamilton being away from the game of baseball and not playing at all, once they were comfortable with where he was from a rehab standpoint, they gave him this sort of the thumbs up. We're going to start playing again. We're going to get on the field and we're going to play baseball again, because that's what he needed, obviously, in his recovery. And the story they share is that they put a batting tee on home plate at Jack Russell Stadium, and Josh Hamilton started to take swings. And in that first round, Buster, Josh Hamilton hit a home run off a batting tee over the center field batter's eye at Jack Russell Stadium, 20 feet high, 400 feet away from home plate. Wow. Josh Hamilton had not swung a bat in years, the way that they had, as the story goes. And Josh Hamilton picking up a baseball bat and hitting a ball off of a tee 400 feet over the hitter's eye in center field is a remarkable story. When people ask me who's the most gifted baseball player I ever watched, the answer to that question for me is Josh Hamilton. Because for someone who has lived such a complicated life, gone through so much, he was so gifted. And when you watch him in that home run derby at Yankee Stadium, given the context of everything that he went through in his life, and you hear these sort of anecdotes from people that knew him well, This is the kind of talent that comes along very rarely. We're lucky that he harnessed it for just a little bit, but obviously there was so much more that he left on the table. But I will never forget the story that those guys down in Clearwater, Florida shared with me.
Yeah, two most talented players I've seen in my time covering baseball, Ken Griffey Jr. and Josh Hamilton. No doubt about it. It's called War of the Roses, Hembo, and you will find it before next week, and you're going to be watching going, okay, now I get it. Yep, okay, Buster's exactly right.
My wife's birthday is on Saturday. I'll tell her movie night, Saturday night, War of the Roses. We'll see how it goes.
All right. I can't wait.
Later, boy.
For players with troubled medical histories, the decision whether to come back and play during the coronavirus outbreak is complicated. One example, Indian star pitcher Carlos Carrasco. My friend and colleague Pedro Gomez has more on that.
Oh, wow. When's the last time you had a haircut?
I got it in the January before I go.
These days, Cleveland Indians pitcher Carlos Carrasco is like many of us. He's spending more time in the house with his wife and five children, homeschooling, and even playing baseball in the kitchen. Which carries its own risks, even during a global pandemic.
I still go to the grocery store. We have to do that, so because we need to eat. I need to feed my family.
What do you look like when you leave the house?
Right here.
Carrasco must adhere to extreme precautions as he might be at higher risk for severe illness from the coronavirus. That's because in June of 2019, following a blood test, doctors told him he has leukemia.
Pedro, I didn't understand anything. Like, so what's going on here? And my wife, she understand pretty clear, and that she told me, hey, Carlo, you had cancer. And I just went like, for 10 seconds, just went like everything, the whole my life in 10 seconds.
Carrasco, whose nickname is Cookie, received an emotional reception at the 2019 All-Star Game in Cleveland.
Carrasco getting the love.
and returned to the mound for the Indians in a limited role in early September. He now says if baseball returns, he is all in.
How are you right now?
I'm good, man. I'm good for me. I know I had cancer, but I've been taking medication for day one to now, in the morning and for bedtime too. And I need to take for the next 3 years.
What have your doctors told you about how to act right now during this pandemic?
Just be home. Just be home and stay safe.
That is Carrasco's conundrum. Just how safe can he be if games resume? He's going to be exposed to dozens of people on a daily basis.
They told me, be careful. Please be careful, because what you have, you can get infected real quick. But if you don't take care of yourself, maybe in 2 months, it's like from stage one, they can go to three or something like that.
As baseball plans its return, there will be regular testing, empty stadiums, and limited travel. But games resuming also could open the door to the coronavirus, a risk for everyone involved, and possibly life or death for Carrasco.
You know, on a baseball field, no one touches a baseball more than a pitcher.
You're right.
There's a ground ball to second base. Maybe the second baseman has licked his hand, gets the ball, throws it out to first. The first baseman throws it right back to you. That ball has been touched by other people. What concerns do you have about that?
They're going to touch every player if they're fine or not. So I think for that part right there, it made me a little bit safe. But I don't know. I don't know how this is going to work out when we start playing baseball.
And that's the bottom line. Nobody knows. Even though the consequences of catching the virus can be fatal for him, Carrasco insists he will play.
I know that I have this disease, cancer, but I just want to be a good dad, and I just want to take care of my family. I know some people that told me you have to take care of yourself because you have this, you have that. But at the same time, as a father, as a son, a friend, brother, I have to do everything for my family.
Cancer has forever changed Carlos Carrasco. He says he appreciates life more than ever, but realizes nothing is promised beyond today.
When somebody receives the news that you had cancer, it's not that easy. Pedro, let me tell you something, because I don't know. Right now, I'm here with you. We're talking here, but I don't know where I can be tomorrow.
Ron Washington is the third base coach of the Atlanta Braves. He was the manager of the Texas Rangers for 8 seasons, and twice the Rangers played in the World Series in 2010, 2011. They won 87 or more games in 5 seasons, Wash, in the time you were the manager. How important would it be for you to get another shot at being a manager?
Well, for me, it'd be very important, because I still think I got the ability, you know, to lead a group and to lead an organization to go exactly where they want to go, that's to the World Series. I've never lost that drive. So I still think I have it. Matter of fact, I know I have it. I don't think I have it, and I definitely do want to manage again. I just hope the opportunity presents itself.
How close did you feel like you came to getting that job in San Diego? It was fairly public that you were one of the finalists.
Well, I felt extremely good about it. You know, I have a relationship with AJ, and I thought I hit it off extremely well with ownership. I thought I met AJ's staff, and I thought we hit it off well. And I really, you know, and having interviewed for a managing job before, you don't want to get too giddy, so to say, until they've told you that you had the job. But I just really felt like my opportunity was going to present itself. But then San Diego decided that they was going to go in a different direction. And, you know, I'm just happy for the opportunity that AJ Pirillo and his family there in San Diego gave.
Wash, you have a great reputation as being incredibly honest, an incredibly hard worker. And you're also, you know, you're old school in some respects, but you've also managed to navigate your way through this shift that the baseball's taken into analytics. And I've bumped into so many former players who asked me, hey, what do I need to do to be able to do that? What would you tell them about finding their way into this new world in which, you know, analytics drives so much of the conversation?
You got to be proactive. You got to do the best that you can to learn what they want to see on the field or learn the direction in which they want the game to travel right now. But also you have to embrace the fact that when you're learning from what they want, they have to learn from what you have to give too. And I think where guys make mistakes is they forget what they know and what they do bring to the table. And just because it's something different, that doesn't mean that you have to get put on the back seat. You got to be proactive. I want to learn what you know, and I'm going to teach you what I know. And in that process, we just keep moving forward because the game is changing. And if you want to be in the game, you have to change with it. You can't get upset about the way things are going to be run or the way they want things done. But, you know, if you embrace what they want you to do, and then they embrace what you want to do, then it works. And I mean, that's the way it has to be. Just because the game is changing, that doesn't mean that you should become dumb to the game of baseball.
No, and no matter what the numbers say, I know you well enough to know that you will say, look, I get what the numbers say, but that's not what I see. That's not what my eyes see. How do you feel like that honesty has worked for you when it comes to dealing with that sort of situation?
Well, I've been very fortunate in the game of baseball with the transition. I started with the transition in analytics with the Oakland A's. You know, it was the first one to try to come up with it. So I learned over there with Billy Beane. And then when I went to Texas, you know, I had some of the best talent that I've ever been around. And we were able to put things together on the field and the way I visioned the game being played. And then after I left Texas and I went to Atlanta, I realized that they were analytic heavy also. So how I did it was I embraced what they had to do. I looked at it, and if I had any questions about it, I asked questions. If I ask you a question, give me an answer. If you ask me a question, I'm going to give you an answer. That's all I want. I'm not asking questions to try to downplay what the numbers say or anything like that. I just want the answer to the question that I ask. And if you answer it, I can see it. I mean, when you're in the room with those analytic guys and they put stuff on the board, it's real. It's for real. It is for real. Some of it, you know, you may say, well, you know, I don't agree with that. But for the most part, if you look at it, it makes sense. Now it's up to you to be able to give it to the kids. And that's the one thing that I've been good with and been very fortunate in the game with is everywhere that I've been that analytics have been heavy, it's been a two-way street. They give it to me. They let me apply it to the guy who's I'm working with so that he can understand it. And, you know, and they explain it to me. And that's how you just keep moving. That's the way the game evolves. Again, it doesn't make any sense to get upset because the game is changing. The game will always be changing.
Wash, a few weeks ago, we talked to Bill James, who, as you know, is sort of the godfather of modern analytics. And he acknowledged that the area of the game that where the numbers don't as truly reflect what's going on more than any other is on defense. How close do you think we are where you are have the belief that the numbers that are generated on defensive analytics are actually reflective of the defensive excellence that you see?
Well, to be honest with you, in the beginning, I was like everyone else. I didn't believe it because, you know, I was used to getting a chart from a pitcher and then take it home and color code it on a diamond. And then as the year progressed, it all comes together. But now they give it to you right away. And I would say between 80 and 85% of the time, the ball is usually hit where the numbers say that it is going to get hit. Sometimes we may overdo it with the shift, but for the most part, 85% of the time, it's right on. And that other 15% is divided up. It might be 5 over here. It might be 3% over there. It might be 9 over there. And the game is willing to give up those little bitty percentages and just make certain that the big part is covered. And it took me a minute. It really did. It took me a while to get used to it. But, you know, you can't deny, like you say, what your eyes see. When I have a chart here where they say a guy should be playing, and I decided to, before I gave into the analytics, I decided to put him here, and then I see the ball go there consistently. It don't take a rocket science to understand this is where he should be. And I understood where it doesn't bother me that the 15, the 8, or the 9% that's not being covered, they're willing to give it to him, and I don't get headaches over it. So it's been working. It really has.
You had a prominent place in the book Moneyball, and then you became one of the prominent characters in the movie Moneyball. What was that like to see yourself played on the big screen?
Well, it was wonderful, and I was there for the premiere. I was managing Texas at the time, and when they premiered it over in San Francisco, I happened to be in town. In Oakland. They premiered it in Oakland, and I just happened to be in town, so I caught the premiere. And, I'll tell you what, we had pitching, we had defense, we had timely hitting. What we didn't do, there was a no-no against running the base stealing. Billy and them hated you to make outs on the base pads. They just hated for you to give away outs. And so we never gave away outs because we never had a bunch of guys that could run anyway. But we could pitch and we could catch the ball. And we never used the hit and run. We did everything according to our personnel. You know, Hudson, Molden, Zito would throw the ball. And Miguel Tejada, Eric Chavez, Mark Gellis, Jason Giamba, they would catch the ball. And I'm not talking about the outfield now. We had some pretty good outfielders out there, too, that could run it down. And we stayed in ball games. And we got a base hit in the seventh or the eighth inning. And one thing that Billy Beane always had during that Moneyball period when I was there, we always had someone that could go in the game late and get us 3 outs. We kept a closer. We always had a closer.
So when you went to the premiere, how hard did you work to meet Brad Pitt?
It was easy. He was wide open there. I mean, he was a swell guy. It was just like a family, really. So
did he recognize you? Did he say, "Oh, you're Ron Washington"? You know, because he obviously had read the book and gone through the movie. I'm curious about how that conversation was.
No, he didn't know. He didn't know I was Ron Washington, and I really didn't try to impress it upon him. You know what I'm saying? I just was happy to shake his hand, happy to meet him. I did mention my name, but I mean, there was so many people that was trying to get a piece of him that my name didn't ring a bell at the time. The premiere was in Oakland. It was at, at 8 o'clock that night. And we had a game the next day, and I was staying in San Francisco. So when the premiere ended, they had an after party. I didn't attend the after party. I got in my car and I went back to San Francisco because we had a game the next day.
So I'm going to ask you the names of some people you've been around in your time in baseball, and just, you know, I'm curious about your stories. Your work with Marcus Semien made such a difference in his career. As you know, there was a time, because of the number of errors that he was making, that there was a question about whether or not he'd be able to continue with shortstop, and last year finished third in the American League in MVP voting. Tell me about why you believed in that he would be able to make that transition.
Well, I believed in it because Billy Beane called me. And when Billy Beane called me, that showed me he believed. Dave Flores believed, and Bob Melvin believed. Those were the 3 guys that could have made a decision on Marcus that could have just interrupted Marcus' career. But they were positive in the fact that they felt like Marcus could be a shortstop, and Billy Beane knew that I could be the guy to help him do it. And the rest is history. You know, you could be the best coach, the best teacher in the world, Buster, but if your student can't apply what you've given to him, then that doesn't make you look good at all. So for me, the credit goes to Billy Beane first, Dave Ford second, Bob Melvin third, because Bob is the one who made the lineup. And he put him in there every day. And then Marcus Semien. I just put the road down there for Marcus to travel, and he never got off that road. He never questioned it one time. And he was a tremendous student. He's a tremendous athlete. He's a tremendous person. He's a tremendous father. He's a very, very special young man. And those people in Oakland knew that. And, you know, you find out what you're made of, and you find out what people are made of when the whole world is against you. And when I arrived in Oakland, there were so many people that didn't think that Marcus Semien could play shortstop. But Ron Washington, Marcus Semien, Billy Beane, Dave Force, and Bob Melvin, we believed. And that's why Marcus is where he is today. So Marcus deserves a lot of credit, and that organization deserves a lot of credit for believing in Marcus.
Describe the energy of Ronald Acuna Jr., Ozzy Albies, to be around them every day.
Off the chart. They don't play the game like 20-year-olds and 21-year-olds. They're above their time, really. They're actually 25 years old, if you ask me, and they're 20 and 21, or 21 and about to be 22. They show up every day. They got one thing on their mind, to be the best that they could possibly be on that day, to make it tough on the opponent that day, and to make their teammates and the organization proud of them every single day. And that's high praise for some young kids. And they are. And they are winners. They listen. You know, you don't meet many 20 and 21-year-olds that have been given opportunity, especially at the major league level in the world today, and they're willing to listen and willing to apply. They don't care about feeling uncomfortable. That's what makes them special. They don't care about feeling uncomfortable because they know that uncomfortable feeling that they have will eventually result in them being a better person, a better player, and a better teammate. And that's the joy that those two kids bring every day when they come to the ballpark.
Wash, I cringed last year when Ozzy signed that the long-term deal that goes through 2027 for $35 million, and he got a lot of criticism for signing that deal. They heard whispers from other players because I felt like that a lot of the criticism it was coming from people who don't know Ozzy or his situation. As someone who knows him, how did you feel?
Well, I felt like this. Ozzy did what Ozzy had to do for his family. You don't know where Ozzy came from. And $35 million, he felt, was enough for him to set his family up for the rest of their life. He didn't want to take the chance on getting hurt. $35 million, he felt. And so, you know, I have no ill feeling about what Ozzy did because he's the one that had to make that decision. I know there was a lot of money out there. But he did what he felt he had to do for him and his family. And so he did it. And by the time that contract is over, he'll still be 26, 27 years old. And he's going to be a superstar. And he'll get his payday. He really will. He won't go backwards. Not Ozzy Albies. He's not going backwards. All he's going to do is continue to move forward. That's the type of talent he is. That's the type of person he is. That's the character he has. You know, he loved the game of baseball, and I'm with everyone else. I knew that he probably could have held out and got more money, but he's the one that made that decision for he and his family. And right now, he and his family don't have to worry about anything in life. And, you know, if he get hurt, he's good. If he don't get hurt, he's going to get a big payday. There's no doubt about it.
What was it like to manage Josh Hamilton, who is, I think, one of the most dynamic talents that we've ever seen in baseball, but obviously he's had a set of challenges in his lifetime?
Well, that's the thing with Josh. We knew he had challenges when he came in. John Daniels he wasn't fazed by the challenges that was coming along with Josh Hamilton. All the people that John Daniels listened to up in the front office, they wasn't worried about the challenge that Josh came with. And I wasn't worried about the challenge with what Josh came with. And I knew that clubhouse, when Josh got there, if Josh just came here and did what Josh is supposed to do, just come there and be a part of the clubhouse, that it wouldn't be any problem. And for 5 years I had Josh, it was never a problem. When he had issues, he and I had a relationship where when he had issues, he could walk in my office, he could lay it on the table, and we would figure out what we had to do. if I couldn't figure it out with him downstairs, we would call upstairs to John. And the buck stopped up there. John would come down, and we would figure out what we had to do to make sure that everything was fine with Josh and his family. So he didn't know it at the time, but he walked into a tremendous situation with John Daniels leading up top, and I'm downstairs, and the guys inside that clubhouse. He walked into a tremendous situation, and for 5 years, he gave us the best that he had.
Well, and if I remember correctly, Wash, you did a heck of a job on a daily basis talking to him. You mentioned him coming in your office. You know, I heard stories that that was a regular thing, that it was part of your way to get him ready to play on a regular basis.
Well, you know, when I kept my door open in my office, and when Josh was passing back and forth, I knew he had something on his mind. And a few times I had to actually run the press out of there so I could let Josh come in and give him time to talk about what he had to talk about and give him time to get prepared for the game. And I don't know how many people know this or if Josh ever spilled the beans on it, but the night he hit the four home runs against the Baltimore Orioles in 2012, he was walking past my office. I ran the media out my office, and that was a verse in the Bible that he wanted to read with me. And we was in a rain delay, and we sit down and we read the Bible, and he got my opinion on what the verse meant to me and what the verse meant to him. And that's the night he went out there and hit four home runs and went 5 for 5 that night. That's the way it used to happen with Josh. One day Josh came to the ballpark in Texas. He said, "Skip, I didn't get no sleep last night. That was about 2:30 in the day." Well, we had this dark room that was like a theater room, but it was dark. And I told him to get a pillow and a blanket, and I'll see him at 5:45. So he left, and the media came in. They wanted to know where Josh was, and I told him, "Don't worry about Josh. He'll be ready at 7 o'clock. And at 5:45, he knocked on my door, and that was the year that he won the MVP. I mean, through that year right there, he won the MVP. So there was a lot of times that if Josh would have just kept to himself, or if he didn't share what he was feeling with his teammate or his handler, it could have been tougher. But we were able to get Josh to talk to us. We were able to get Josh to tell us what he was feeling. And we never judged him. We just did as a group, as a family member, what we could to help him get through that day. And it was many days like that, but it was the norm. It wasn't anything that I felt or John Daniels felt or his teammates felt that it took us out of who we were or anything like that, or would make a big scene in the clubhouse or would cause him to be treated differently. It was Josh Hamilton. And for us to get Josh to get 500 and something at bat, for us to get Josh to hit that field for 150 something games, which we wanted, we had to do what we had to do, and that's what we did. But that was never a problem with Josh.
Wash, I once asked Dave Dombrowski, this was after the Tigers came so close to beating the Red Sox in the 2013 American League Championship Series. And I asked him, you know, how long did it take him to get over that that series loss? Because if you look back at it, the Tigers dominated about 90% of that series. And he said, you know, I really haven't gotten over it. It was the following spring. I'm wondering about you and 2010, 2011. When you think back to Game 6 in 2011, you guys repeatedly within one strike of winning the World Series. You've had a lifetime in baseball. How do you process that? Or is it something that still kind of gnaws at you?
Well, it will always gnaw at you when you, because you play this game to win a World Series. And I got the two World Series, and one of them I had a chance to actually win, the first one in 2010. We didn't have a chance against the Giants. They pitched well. We didn't pitch very well. They scored a bunch of runs. But the one in 2011, I don't think I will ever get over that, being one pitch away twice from going to the World Series. But, you know, it was two champions playing. One had to win and one had to lose. And but I'll never get over 2011. Never. I just will always remember. And the thing that you asked me, the thing that I thought about when we lost that game was, it wasn't about me. It was about me going up in there being strong for my group, because we did have one more day to come back out here. And I had to be strong for them. So whatever I felt at the time, I couldn't tell you what I felt. I was still focused on the one game we had left. And then when we lost it, and then we got back, and then we had our meeting two days later in Texas, because John Daniels didn't waste any time. We had our meeting 2 days in Texas to go over what just happened and what we're going to do to get past it into the next year. That's when I fell apart, talking about the game, and I realized what we just lost. And from that point on, you know, it keep gnawing at you. You never lose it because you're so close. You're so close, and you can't ever take for granted that you're going to have an opportunity at a World Series. And I went back-to-back years and still lost. So the heartache is always going to be there.
David Freese we had on a few weeks ago, and it was very interesting that he told us that when after he tied the game and then you guys took the lead, Josh Hamilton hits a home run. David said that he was standing at his position at third base when the Cardinals fell behind. And in his mind, he made peace with the idea that they were going to lose the series. He goes, you know what? Josh is a great story. This is really good for baseball if they win it and Josh is a heroic role in it. And so David had that mindset as competitive as he is, and yet they come back and win. And, you know, he's a good guy. Have you ever gotten a chance to talk to him, or would you even talk to him about that?
No, I'm friends with David. I am. I like his attitude. He's a gamer. You know, I'm real friends with David, and every time I see him, we get that respect to each other. As I said, there was two champions out there battling. One had to win and one had to lose. And we just ended up coming on the short end of it. And the one thing that claws at me the most is three times I had mentioned to Gary about being in no doubles. And he was slicing balls down the right field line. And one of them, he hit down the right field line. Excuse me. Cruz almost went to the line and caught it. And then, I really didn't hit Gary up again about was we in doubles. Because each time I asked him, he was adamant that they were. But we didn't see Nelson creep up. And then he hit that ball. And the couple steps that Nelson creeped up could have been the couple steps that he would have sit there and caught the ball. But I didn't get upset with Nelson, because if it wasn't for Nelson, we wouldn't have been there anyway. He told Detroit up. All that pitching Detroit had, they couldn't do nothing with Nelson Cruz, and Nelson Cruz was the reason we was there. So we lost. That was the mantra of that club. When we lost, we all had a piece of it. We didn't point fingers, and I certainly wasn't going to point fingers at Nelson when that ball got over his head. So it was just one of those things, and it wasn't meant to be. Tony La Russa had used his whole bench. Darren Oliver has been deaf on left-handers, and he went out there and he had faced two lefties and a pitcher. Tony had ran out of players. So to face two lefties and a pitcher, and you wouldn't believe those two lefties came up with base hits. Pitcher bunted them over, and the rest is history.
Wash, I always love talking with you. You know, I always respect your work, and you're so respected within the game for your honesty and for that work ethic. I appreciate you talking with us and distracting us in this tough time.
Well, thank you, Buster. I appreciate it. I really got a little giddy when I seen the text, and I couldn't wait to talk with you, and I'm glad we was able to hook up.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster, Bleacher Tweets for Wednesday here. First one up, our guy, the man, the myth, the legend, former producer on Baseball Tonight podcast, Troy Farkas at Troy_Farkas writes in, if/when baseball returns, will there be home and away masks? What do you think?
Well, first off, I'm glad that Troy sent us that question before he listened to the Ron Washington interview, because if he had heard that, he would have been lying on the floor in a pool of tears, because as a Rangers fan, he would have been so embittered with reliving the 2011 World Series. He wouldn't have been able to even function. I'm guessing that if Troy's idea is right, the home away mask, which would be pretty cool for him, he'd be wearing at home anything that had a Rangers logo on it. What do you think?
Absolutely. And there's about a 0% chance he listens to the Ron Washington interview. And I'm trying to go back in our producer ESPN chat, because I think David Freese came up, or something came up in our producer chat, and he just went off, and it was a little bit awkward, but I respect his passion, and I'm glad that he's still chiming in here. Last one for today. Darren Wong at DWong underscore writes in, we've heard a lot about baseball ops and player salaries, but where do coaching salaries fall in terms of cuts? Any grumblings from that part of the sport?
No question. A lot of grumblings, a lot of concern. And I would expect that if there's no baseball, you're going to see those guys potentially furloughed as well. Like the furloughs that we're talking about with the Angels and so many other teams, they are going to cut deeply. Which is why within the baseball industry, the teams that have guaranteed to keep people on through October, the Padres are in that mix. The Detroit Tigers are in that mix. They're like folk heroes now. Like they've gained so much. You know, sometime coming up, I'm going to have a conversation about that because I have heard some really interesting observations about the teams that aren't making these cuts and how this is going to benefit them going forward.
Interesting stuff. Thanks for writing in, Bleacher Tweeters, hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. And tomorrow, I'm very excited. We've got Wayne Kirby on the podcast. Great stories with him.
Absolutely. He, of course, a longtime coach, Texas Rangers, Baltimore Orioles, now the San Diego Padres. He's got stories about Manny Ramirez and other that moment when Jason Grimsley retrieved Albert Bell's bat from the umpire's room. Kerbs is a great storyteller, and he talks about fostering the relationship with players through his humor and his honesty. That's it for today. My thanks to Wash, to Hembo, and to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/PodCenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.